Hey everyone, Michael here with the Bitcoin Way podcast. Thank you for tuning in. Today on the show, we have Diverter No KYC and Econo Alchemist. We brought them in for a special Samurai edition of the show. We talk all things Samurai, what it is, what tools the Samurai developers created, their arrest, and even how you can help fund their legal defense, which they desperately need. I encourage you to stay tuned to the end to hear more about that. One final comment. In post-production, we had an issue with Econo Alchemist's audio, and so we actually took samples of his voice, ran it through AI, married it up with the transcript, and so the voice that you're hearing when he's speaking is not actually his voice. We got his permission, but I just wanted to let you know that, and we'll note it on the video as well. Thank you so much again for tuning in. I think you're going to love this show. Hey, everyone. Like I said in the intro, I've got Econo and Diverter here. Gentlemen, welcome to the show. Thank you so much for joining this special edition podcast on all things Samurai.
Yeah. Thanks. Glad to be here. Really glad you're doing this. We need to raise as much as knowledge about the situation as we can. So thanks a lot.
Yeah, certainly.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks for the invite. Happy to be here and, you know, just to offer my perspective for what it's worth. And hopefully my words can convince some people to take some action and get in the fight and start supporting the legal defense fund for these guys.
Yeah, I think that it's a good cause that you two are united around, and we're hoping to help spread the message. So, so I'll start with the first question is you guys jump in, maybe if you want to spend just, you know, 20, 30 seconds telling people a little bit about you, what it is you do, and how you got involved, and then answer the question and we'll proceed from there. So I told you offline, I've only been at Bitcoin a couple of years. So I've heard of Samurai, sort of, you know, understand basically what the team did, but I don't really understand the full scope of products that they were offering, what they were doing. Could one of you maybe start with a little bit about Samurai and the services provided?
Sure. Yeah, I'll take off here. So I'm Diverter. I got into Bitcoin. Originally, I first bought Bitcoin in 2016, I guess it was. I had no idea what I had bought. I thought that it was like a stock. I had done zero research. I was just looking for a way to not, you know, bleed all my money away. I had correctly identified inflation as the source of a lot of my problems. So I'm looking for a way to save some money, but, you know, I just thought it was a stock. So the big bull run happens. Of course, since I thought I had a stock, after it went up about 20%, I sold and I was, you know, happy. Like, that's a good gain. And then I watched it run all the way up to $20,000 and I was losing my mind. And that's when I realized there's something, I obviously don't understand what I'm doing here. So I did a whole lot of research, as one does, fell down the quote unquote rabbit hole, and really fell in love with Bitcoin. So funnily enough, the first wallet that I ever downloaded was Samurai. And that happened because I have no idea what I'm doing. So I get on Google Play Store and I just search Bitcoin wallet and I just started scrolling, looking for what I thought was the coolest logo. That's what I was looking for. And I stumbled on Samurai and I said, oh man, there it is. This is me right here. So I download it, open it up, make me a wallet. Had absolutely no idea what tool I had in my hand at that time. I mean, zero understanding of it. Now, at that time, just some of the things that Samurai was offering that nobody else does still to this day, or something called steganographic transactions. It's something called a stowaway, which is a transaction that you can make with another Samurai wallet user, where if you're a Samurai wallet user and I'm a user as well, and I want to send you funds, we can do a stowaway transaction where what ends up happening is you contribute an input to the transaction and I contribute an input to the transaction. So on chain, what it looks like is a two input, two output transaction, which is very, very standard, normal looking Bitcoin transaction. But in reality, what's happened is we've broken one of the biggest, most common heuristics in Bitcoin. And we probably need to define some of these terms for users too. So I'll go back and do that. but it undermines the common input ownership heuristic. That's a big, big, big thing that people need to understand. And the common input ownership heuristic is one of the main things used by chain surveillance companies to track Bitcoin transactions. All right, so I'm getting a little ahead of myself, so I'm going to back up and define some of these things. But I just wanted to mention that, like, Samurai was the first wallet that I used. I personally did not understand it at all for a very long time. I ended up getting rid of Samurai, going backwards. I used blockchain.info wallet. I used several not so good wallets. All right. And then made my way full circle back around to Samurai once I understood Bitcoin and once I understood the privacy failings of Bitcoin. So there's a lot to get into because I want users to understand why Samurai is so important, why some of the things that people don't even think about in their Bitcoin transactions, Samurai takes care of in the background. So a lot of these things are very important to really understand why it is, in fact, Samurai that are in the crosshairs right now, because I think that's a big, big part of it.
Yeah. Ikano, do you have anything to add to that?
Sure. Yeah, I'll just start with my brief introduction. I'm pseudonym Ikano Alchemist. I have a pretty similar introduction into Bitcoin a little bit later than Diverter. I got into it at the end of 2018, thinking that it was a stock, you know, not really understanding the problems with money and transacting that Bitcoin solved at the time. But a few Andreas Antonopoulos videos later, and I could really see the potential in Bitcoin for solving issues that come with the weaponization of basic financial services. And so I just fell down the rabbit hole really quickly. And it didn't take me long to figure out that by using KYC information, I was really handicapping the ability for this new tool I found to do all the awesome things that I thought it could do, like give me that financial freedom without having to trust third parties. And so it didn't take me very long to become, like, I don't want to say like anti-KYC, but just like pro-privacy, pro-anonymity, trying not to use these centralized services that require your KYC information. Because once they attach your KYC information to your Bitcoin transactions, then it becomes very easy to unravel any of the anonymity that you've gained by using this technology. And therefore, you're just as liable to be held accountable as you would be using any traditional financial tool that's available to you in the legacy banking system. Yeah, it was around that time that I found Samurai Wallet, and I had heard that they had implemented this CoinJoin feature called Whirlpool. And so that's really what attracted me to Samurai Wallet. And I was interested in that because Bitcoin is a very transparent ledger, and anybody with an internet connection can look at every transaction and follow the traces of funds through the transaction graph. And Samurai Wallet was offering something that, like Diverter was saying, broke those heuristics and messed with the tactics that people used to trace funds across the blockchain. And so, you know, really what Samurai Wallet was for me, what it is objectively is it's a mobile first Bitcoin wallet application. And it has multiple tools built into it that help people gain anonymity on a public ledger and thus helps people preserve their privacy, which, you know, just when I say privacy, I'm talking about the ability for a person to selectively reveal information about themselves. And so that's really what Samurai Wallet is at the core. But it's also a lot more than that. There's like a full stack of infrastructure that's built in behind Samurai Wallet. So if you are a default user, you would connect to their Dojo, which is their Bitcoin node that they offered. And there's also a separate developer team called Ronin Dojo. And those guys built a node package for individuals to run themselves so that you wouldn't have to connect to Samurai Wallet's Dojo. You could connect to your own Dojo with your Samurai Wallet client from your mobile phone. And then, you know, they also had the Whirlpool coordinator built in. Eventually, they built the Soroban server. It's an app agnostic Tor communication protocol that helps you communicate privately. And they use that in a really neat way to help facilitate transactions peer-to-peer that are like miniature coin joints. Like Diverter was saying, Stowaway is one of those where you got multiple parties putting inputs in. And then some of the tools that they had that also used that were the Stonewall X2. Then additional tools that they had built in that weren't multi-party were the Ricochet tool, which was mentioned in the indictment.
Okay. So they had a, it wasn't simply a wallet the way many people think of a, you know, a mobile wallet application. There was a lot happening on the back end that, and it sounds like really their philosophy was oriented toward privacy, toward anonymity to the extent that you wanted it. Yeah. Diverter, could you maybe elaborate on the Stowaway feature? So you said it looks sort of like a standard transaction, but what's different about it that provides some of that privacy?
Sure. Yeah. And yes, you're exactly right. So Samurai, the focus obviously is privacy, privacy and mobile first. So the motto of Samurai Wallet is a Bitcoin wallet for the streets. All right. So there are several meanings, you know, that a person can derive from that. But the point being, most wallets, I would argue, most wallets in the Bitcoin space, virtually all of them, to be honest, save for a few. What they are designed to do is they are designed to allow you to purchase Bitcoin somewhere and then try to store it safely. That's the design. Samurai was designed as a wallet that you can acquire Bitcoin and then use that Bitcoin, not just store it safely. And that's not to say that Bitcoin can't be stored safely in Samurai. It obviously can, seeing as everything I own is in a Samurai wallet. So it has been like that for some years. But the design is for you to be able to actually use this thing for whatever you want to use it for, not just as like a piggy bank. And that's a big, big difference. That design decision makes a massive changes. So if you're going to design a wallet to actually spend Bitcoin, then you very quickly realize that Bitcoin is absolutely horrible at privacy. Horrible. Especially if you use one of the centralized KYC services like Econo's talking about. Then, you know, it's very, very, very difficult to do anything. It's virtually impossible to do anything with and have any sort of privacy. Now, if Bitcoin is supposed to be peer-to-peer digital cash, well, when you go get cash out of your ATM, you have privacy now. You can go spend that cash wherever you want, and the bank has absolutely no idea where that cash went. Now, if you go to the online equivalent of a bank, say like a Coinbase exchange, and you buy Bitcoin and you withdraw it, so now you've taken your digital cash into your wallet, well, you are not afforded the same privacy that you have in the legacy system. So in fact, Bitcoin privacy is worse than what we have in the current legacy financial system. So all Samurai was trying to do was say, okay, we want to make a wallet where you're going to be able to spend Bitcoin. Very quickly, we understand we can't just offer a surveillance tool, because that's all it would really be if you just didn't do anything. The Bitcoin transactions are very easily traced, and they're traced using these things called heuristics. And all that's just a big fancy word for educated guess at the end of the day. That's all a heuristic is. A heuristic is a pattern that they'll notice. That helps them make a very, very good educated guess on where the Bitcoin flows in a transaction. All right. So really quickly, common input ownership heuristic, which is a very, very, very big one, that says that if you look at a transaction on the blockchain, just say, for example, you spend all the Bitcoin in your wallet. Now, your wallet may show you just one total balance, but in reality, what you probably have in there are several different UTXOs of varying sizes. All right. So you can think of it like having a pocket full of change, right? And each one of those coins is a UTXO. All right. Now, if you're going to spend your entire pocket full of change, then you're going to have to combine all those coins and hand them over. The combination of those coins means that you are the owner of all those coins. So that means the inputs, all of the inputs on the input side of the transaction, whether there are one, two, or 50, if they are on the input side of the transaction, that tells chain surveillance companies that all that Bitcoin belongs to one person, one entity. All right. So from that single deduction, now they can start going backwards and they can start following every transaction backwards. And they can use other heuristics like unnecessary inputs, the chain heuristics. They can look at the type of address that the transaction was sent from and sent to. All these things add up to show a big graph, and you can very easily follow it. So Samurai comes in. They know that this is the case. So they start offering tools that allow a user, without having to build these transactions themselves, that's the big part. You don't have to go into a terminal and try to figure out how to sign all these different inputs and transactions. Like the wallet is going to allow it to build it for you. So a total starter, a noob can do this without having any real knowledge of what they're actually doing. But what it allows you to do is the stowaway. For example, I want to pay you. We're both Samurai users. So we're going to elect to do a stowaway transaction. Using Soroban, it's really, really easy, which is at what Kano mentioned, is just a communications protocol. So on using Soroban, we would both just open our wallets and choose to collaborate on a transaction. And our wallets would talk to each other over this communication layer. And those wallets would build a transaction. They'll take an input from your wallet. So they'll pull one UTXO from you, and they'll pull a UTXO from me. And they will combine those two to into one single transaction. And then they will return your change to you and return my change to me. And now the change that gets returned to me is going to be less the amount I'm sending to you. And the change that gets returned to you is going to be what you input plus what you're getting sent to you. Okay, so if you look at it on chain, you see a two input, two output transaction, which is very, very common. It just looks like you combine two inputs in your wallet, and then you paid someone, that's one output, and then you got your change back, that's the other output. Very common transaction. So a chain surveillance company will look at that and assume all that Bitcoin belongs to one person. That's incorrect. So it's going to, even though they may not know that common input ownership heuristic has been broken right there, it has been broken. And so their analysis from that point forward is flawed now. So it's just a case of, essentially, it's muddying the waters. You can't really achieve true anonymity on a public ledger. You can get pseudonymity, and you can't really just fake everything. So what you have to do is you have to use basically math. You have to use mathematical principles to try to increase the doubt and decrease how sure they are that all of these transactions are doing what they think they're doing. So I know I got a little long-winded there, but it's really, really important to understand how powerful that is.
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense and is a very cool tool. I guess my one follow-up question for you then, you gave a simple example of like a two input, two output transaction. In practice, could that have been, you know, a 10 input, you know, two output transaction or something like that I guess that wouldn't be helpful. Maybe a 10 input, 10 output transaction. So that way you muddy the waters even further, or was it typically just, you know, or was it UTXO dependent, depending on how many UTXOs were required for the transaction?
There you go. So you hit it on at the end. It's UTXO dependent. Also, there are very strict rules that Samurai obviously built into the protocols of these spending tools. So you had Stonewall X2, You have Stonewall, Stonewall X2, and Stowaway. Those are the three on-demand kind of CoinJoin or fake CoinJoin transactions, because they also had a fake one that looked exactly like the two-person CoinJoin, but it's not. It was all you. So again, it's just to increase the doubt. So when they hit one of these transactions, all we want them to do is say, I don't know. I don't know for sure. I think this happened, but I don't really know. That is miles better than what's called a deterministic transaction. But yes, to your point, the rules have to be satisfied by your wallet. And that means you have to have a correct set of UTXOs, because what the wallet was really, really, really good at is putting up what I call guardrails that don't allow a user to shoot themselves in the foot. That's such a big thing that most people do. You shoot yourself in the foot. So Samurai had really high, really good guardrails, so it wouldn't allow you to inadvertently select some UTXOs that you shouldn't combine. Because if you, to your point, when you talked about the 10 input, 10 output, that's essentially a major coin join right there. Because you're gonna be giving away information about a lot more than if it's just like a one input, one output, or one input from you, one output from me, or if it's 10 inputs from me and one output from you. It changes. All that math changes. Everything changes based off that. So Samurai kept it very simple. They made basic rules that would protect the user while also allowing them to gain some sort of privacy on this public ledger.
So what of these tools are still available? You said that you still have your stack in a Samurai wallet. Are a lot of these tools offline now? Have they been captured? I mean, what's sort of the status of Samurai, I guess, as a suite of services?
So at the moment, there really is no Samurai suite to speak of, other than the wallet still works perfectly fine. As long as you are running your own node, I should say. So as long as if you're running your own Dojo node, then the wallet still works perfectly fine. You could send transactions, receive transactions, all that. Actually, the Stowaway and the Stonewall X2 and the Stonewall, so all these transactions that I've been talking about right here, they actually still work. So the way that stuff was developed, it started out as being QR codes that you had to share with your partner. So you would have to pass 5 QR codes back and forth to each other to build this transaction. Now, eventually, Samurai developed Soroban, which basically took care of all that heavy lifting in the background on this communications protocol. So you no longer had to manually share these QR codes. But that never stopped working. You could always share those QR codes either in person, or you can send them through a messaging service and just scan the QR, send it back, scan the QR, send it back. And you can eventually build your transaction that way. So that stuff still works. Whirlpool is no longer working right now. The wallet's no longer getting developed, but as I'm sure we'll maybe touch on later, there has been a new wallet that was forked from Samurai that has sprung up very recently. So that's promising.
That's good to hear. I'm looking forward to hearing more about that. So let's talk a little bit about the developers. So Keon and William and imagine they had a team, but they're the two that we're going to be discussing. Could you just talk a little bit about them, their background, sort of their, my understanding is they had a rather large, colorful personalities online. Any sort of insights you'd like to give the audience on who these two guys are?
Eco, you want a piece of this? First of all, let me just say this. These two guys are some of the best people you'll ever meet in your life. All right. And I'm not just saying that because I'm on here and all this stuff. Like, I genuinely mean it. Great people. However, what they also are uncompromising people. And they actually helped me quite a bit to have a better understanding of a lot of things. And one of my favorite things about them, even if I disagreed with some of them, which I did, but that's fine. One of my favorite things about them was their take on red lines. All right. And what that means is you have to have certain red lines that you absolutely will not ever cross, no matter what. And so there are several of those. If you go back and look through the, as you correctly stated, quite colorful online personalities of our guys, there are several red lines. One of those being no KYC services, no personal information is going to be collected from our users. That's a big one. Right? And so they did not collect any personal information because they didn't think we had to. But also that was a red line. We'll never cross that. So what I'll say about them is they never believed they were doing anything illegal. And so because of that, if anybody that is what I'll call a shit talker, anybody that enjoys to be a shit talker, what you do is if you know that you're not doing anything wrong, man, you really let it go, right? Because you can talk all this shit. You can say all this. You can taunt. You can do all kinds of stuff. If you're actually doing something wrong, you don't do any of that, right? You kind of sit in the corner. You be real quiet. You hope nobody notices you. They didn't think they were doing anything wrong. They were following well-established FinCEN guidance. So when you get online and you look at some of their spicy tweets, because there are some spicy tweets, you have to put that in context. You have to keep in mind, they truly believed that they were not doing anything wrong. So it's not taunting. It's what I've taken to calling, it's rabble-rousing. It's trying to rally the troops. It's trying to get everybody to see how these governments are taking your power away from you, to see how normalized this surveillance has come. This is not normal. It's not normal to have, when you download something, to have to hand over your entire identity and take a cute little picture standing there with a piece of paper. That's not normal. Like all these things that have been normalized in society and we've just come to accept them, that's not normal. So these were guys that were pushing back on that and saying, no, you don't have to accept that. That's not okay. And so because of that, you know, you get your message across best when you are kind of waking people up with the words that you choose. So they were very spicy online, but it was all well-intentioned and it was never on the lines of taunting. It was trying to get people to wake up. And again, the biggest point, nobody ever thought there was anything being done wrong. That was the biggest point.
Yeah. Ikana, you got anything to add to that?
Yeah. And I have to apologize. I just having trouble unmuting my mic, but I'm good now. Yeah. And I'll echo what Diverter was saying. You know, the developers behind Samurai Wallet were very courageous people who knew exactly what they believed in and what they valued. And they were willing to put up a fight to defend what they believed in and to not back down when anyone approached them, trying to get them, trying to silence them, or trying to make fun of them, or trying to put up any resistance to them. If someone hit Samurai, while they would hit back twice as hard and they knew where they stood on issues and they would draw a bold red line and they would speak up and defend those lines anytime someone tried to cross them, you know, and they were just too, you know, and I met them multiple times at conferences and hung out with them in person. I consider them my friends, just like I consider Diverter my friend. And dude, they were some of like the nicest, most caring, like just normal, cool dudes you could ever hang out with. And, you know, it's just a total travesty what's happened here with their case, because usually the Department of Justice will send out a cease and desist notice, but none of that happened. They just went straight for the jugular with Samurai Wallet and indicted them right off the bat. Knowing the guys the way that I know them, I do believe that they're going to continue to stand and fight for what they believe in. If you're someone out there who shares any of the same values or perspectives that they share, for example, if you think code is speech or if you think you should be able to transact collaboratively with your Bitcoin with other people, if you believe in anything that the potential Bitcoin can achieve, then I think you're on the same side as them, and you should get in the fight and support the Legal Defense Fund, because this is a big case and things are going to get exponentially worse. And the resistance in this space is going to get a lot tougher if the government wins this case. If you look at the, just one final thought, and I'll pass the mic, but if you look at the recent statement from the judge in the Tornado Cash case, she said that the functionality of the code is not protected under free speech or something to that effect. And that's in direct contrast to explicitly what was stated in the Bernstein versus US case, which is a series of cases that went all the way up to the Supreme Court, which is where we got the definition that code is speech during the cryptography battles. And in that court decision, Bernstein versus the US, it's explicitly stated that the fact that the software has a function does not exclude it from being free speech. It is still free speech. And so, you know, I think this case with Tornado Cash paints a very clear trajectory. I think some people like Diverter and myself included have seen this trajectory coming for a long time. And we've been trying to sound the alarm bells for years. And I don't know what it's going to take for more people to wake up and get in and fight and support this effort any way they can. I just think that there's a lot on the line and the trajectory is really clear where this is headed if there's not some resistance put up against the government who's trying to erode our rights and freedoms.
Yeah, the way I'm looking at this is it seems like there's maybe like a two-pronged perspective that the government might have in attacking these guys in particular. So one, it seems just based on what you two have been talking about, they're a threat to cash, right? Like the privacy of cash, they're trying to bring that to Bitcoin because it's not inherent in the protocol. But the second is, and we've seen this around the world, a ton of stories in the UK about just general attacks on free speech. And it sort of makes me wonder if first of all, not only was the code, was it directly impacting their control of money, I guess you could say, because it provided an alternative with the actual utility of using something like physical cash, but also the spicy tweets and like these guys were, you know, kind of stirring the pot. Would you say maybe that I'm hitting on something here as to why they were targeted versus, you know, plenty of other people are using code that is then misused for illegal purposes? Silk Road style. I mean, you could still use Bitcoin or anything, you know, lots of other tools for buying drugs, buying illegal firearms, whatever.
Yeah.
Is that why you think they were targeted here?
I mean, that's definitely a part of it. So I think this is certainly a very, very targeted prosecution for Samurai Wallet in particular. And I have several ideas about why, but it basically boils down to a couple of things. So Bitcoin is kind of at this crossroads, if you will, where you know, a lot more companies, countries, presidential candidates, like the quote unquote adults in the room are here, right? So they're here now. Us nerds took it long enough, right? Like, good job, nerds. You all got it here. But now the adults in the room are here. And now Bitcoin has to, you know, grow up. And it has to become like an actual part of this legacy financial institutions. And you have to kind of straighten your back a little bit and put on a tie and all this shit. That's not the case, number one. Bitcoin is doing just fine. We do not need any adults in the room. That was the whole point, was to kick the adults out of the room and let this protocol take over. So that's a big part of it, where we're kind of entering what I believe is ultimately like the final push to really integrate Bitcoin into a legacy financial system instead of allowing it to be what it was designed to be, which is its own standalone parallel system. And the more you try to graft Bitcoin onto our legacy financial system, the more you realize it really doesn't fit, but they're just making it fit. So they're putting the square peg in the round hole any way they need to. And what they have to do along the way is they have to get people basically to go along. So you got a couple different ways you can do that. One of the ways you can do that is you can pick out the biggest, baddest, meanest guy you see and knock him out. And then what does everybody else do? Right? Do you think they're going to all jump up and now and come jump you? Or are they going to say, dude, that dude knocked out the baddest dude I've ever seen in my life. I'm doing whatever he says. That's a very obvious tactic. It's been used for years and years and years, centuries. So what they're trying to do here is they're trying to take essentially the one development team that is doing so much for Bitcoin privacy. It's legitimately Bitcoin privacy is hanging by a thread because nobody else works on it. And when I say nobody, I don't actually mean nobody, but I almost mean nobody. It's so few people that actually work on Bitcoin privacy. Most of the people that have been interested in working on Bitcoin privacy have long since jumped to a different coin. They're on Monero. They're on whatever, XHV or whatever. They've gone to a different coin. They've started their own coin, like, because it's the Bitcoin privacy. It's very frustrating. It's very frustrating because a lot of people don't want privacy on Bitcoin. A lot of people feel like privacy on Bitcoin is actually a hindrance to the price going up. That's where the real battle gets in. So these guys, they stuck it out. They're like the last stronghold of Bitcoin privacy. If they go down, all the pieces around it crumble. They built their own or acquired OXT, which was a sort of like a self-defensive chain analysis platform where you as a user could go on OXT and you could use very similar tools as what the chain surveillance companies are using to track you. You can get access to those same tools and you can start to begin to see how this stuff works and learn how do you need to protect yourself. That's a big part. They're building, things like Sorban, which is, it's app agnostic. It's a Tor-based communications layer that can be used for virtually anything, private messaging, like several different applications that can be used for. They've got this obviously amazing wallet with the one CoinJoin in the one coordinated coin join in Bitcoin that provides actual perfect entropy. Like, this is the gold standard team. If we can just knock these two out, then everything else falls apart. So I think that's a big part of it. But here's the real reason I think. I think they decided to come after them because the spicy tweets, the things that they've said online, right? They can point to that as the real reason. Like, oh, this is why they said this. They brought this on themselves, whatever. So it makes the average person look at this and say, ah, yeah, they kind of did it to themselves. So you don't really raise a big stink about it. Ah, yeah, well, they were kind of assholes. They kind of deserve it, to be honest. You might not say that out loud, but you kind of think that in your mind. Yeah, I mean, these guys were kind of dicks, like, you know. We can do Bitcoin privacy some other time, but they were just dicks. So you don't really stand up and fight for it. What you don't realize is this is not a privacy battle. This is a battle over self-custody itself. And if you don't believe me, just look at what the arguments that are being made. The arguments that are being made are a little bit about privacy, but mostly about self-custody, about the fact that a non-custodial wallet, Samurai was non-custodial wallet forever. It never took any custody of your funds ever at any point, fully non-custodial. They are being charged with conspiracy to run an unlicensed money transmitter business. So they're being charged as if they were running a custodial wallet, but they always ran a non-custodial wallet. So the actual attack isn't privacy. It's the fundamental basic principle of self-custody. And people are getting snowballed into believing this is just a privacy fight. And these guys are just dicks. That's why I don't really have to worry about it. But I'm telling you, there are much bigger implications here.
Yeah, it seems like they're going after the lions because then there will only be sheep left.
Correct.
And this was like an obvious one to hit. Let's get in a little bit to the arrest. And Ikano, if you want to jump in here, could you maybe explain what the charges are, on what basis, however flimsy, those charges are being brought?
Yeah, sure. So they were both indicted pre-dawn raids conducted the morning of April 24th, one in the United States, one in Europe. They were charged with two counts, both conspiracy charges. The first one was conspiracy to operate an unlicensed money transmitter business, and the second one was conspiracy to conduct money laundering. So the thing about operating the conspiracy to operate an unlicensed money transmitter business, if you are considered a money services business, which money transmitters are, then there's certain rules you have to follow and regulations that are enforced by FinCEN, the Financial Crimes Enforcement Network. And so they want money services, businesses, especially money transmitters, to collect, know your customer information. So that's where you're providing a picture of your driver's license and a photo of yourself holding your driver's license in a video and name, date of birth, social security number, like you name it. They collect all your information that's called Know Your Customer, KYC. So money services businesses are expected to collect that information, and then they're supposed to use that information to help enforce these anti-money laundering rules and check.
Ikano, you cut out there for a minute.
Yeah, I think we might have lost him.
Yeah, we'll give him a second. Diverter, you wanna take over where he left off for a moment?
Sorry, can you guys hear me?
Oh, there he is.
Sorry, I can't let my screen fall asleep, otherwise it shuts my mic off.
You're good. Continue.
Where did you lose me at?
You were talking about money transmitters, the use of KYC for anti-money laundering purposes.
So yeah, all that is to say, like, the, you know, they want to see money services, businesses using KYC information to help uphold these like anti-money laundering rules, which is just, can I cuss on this podcast? It's complete bullshit because, you know, just a quick tangent, anti-money laundering laws are a complete farce. There's a guy who's done this study. His name is Ronald Pohl, and he put out this very in-depth analysis of the efficiency of anti-money laundering laws. And what he found was that there's $3 trillion every year of criminal proceeds and confiscations resulting from the enforcement of anti-money laundering laws account for $1.5 billion of that $3 trillion, or a 0.05% effective rate on stopping the flow of criminal funds, which means that 99.95% of criminal funds every year are being spent the way the criminals intend that money to be spent. So, and this is just in the legacy financial realm, you know, so it's just the fact that there's so much burden placed on companies to enforce these rules and regulations. They're completely ineffective at actually stopping the flow of criminal funds. Like, just from my perspective, AML laws are completely bullshit anyways. But everyone in the Bitcoin space, to bring it back to Samurai Wallet, any developers, projects, software teams, they were basing their decisions on what very little guidance existed in this space, because this is a new territory. So the government hasn't been very clear about its stance on a number of things. What the government did do was FinCEN provided some guidance in 2013. And then further clarification on that guidance in 2019. And that was like the gold standard for how you were going to operate in this space, as I'll just lump all these groups together as quote unquote service provider. And if you were a service provider, like developing a wallet or any other thing in the space, you are basing your decisions on some statements made in that FinCEN guidance that said, if you do not take possession of the user's funds and you do not fully control the user's funds, then you are not considered a money services business, and therefore your activity is not regulated under the Bank Secrecy Act and all the other rules and regulations that Benson is in control of enforcing. And so that was it. Was like, okay, if we're non-custodial, then we're not a money services business. And so Samurai Wallet, for example, is a non-custodial wallet. They never took possession of users' funds. The users always maintain full control over their own funds at every single point, in every single function of the wallet that they could possibly use. And so for me, the fact that they're being charged with conspiracy to run an unlicensed money services business is just complete horseshit because they never took possession of the user's funds.
And to add to that, the charge is conspiracy to operate. So like what the hell does that mean? Like they're running this business that isn't, but maybe the claim from the feds is that, well, it is, you know, they should be a licensed money transmitter, but why conspiracy charges then? Why not, you know, not to suggest that they should be charging them with directly violating that requirement, but I'm not even following the logic here of the authorities.
No, it's easier to prove conspiracy because all you have to do is show that they had intent and thought about it. You don't have to prove that they actually did it.
Right. So I think you're following the logic pretty well, actually. It's conspiracy is the fit. If you know anything about the legal system, that's their magic word. That's their magic word for everything. So you don't have to actually prove that anybody did anything wrong. You just have to prove that two people got in a room together somewhere and potentially talked about maybe doing something wrong. And so this is why they're going to probably, I would assume, try to use like tweets and marketing materials and things of that nature to say, well, they had the intent to launder money. The problem with that is, and again, I'm not a lawyer, so, you know, don't come to me for legal advice. But what they're trying to do here is stretch the definition of money laundering as well. They're changing what money laundering has always been. Like money laundering, if you're laundering money, what do? You obtain some ill-gotten gains from somewhere, right? And you do what? You go to a casino and you give them your cash and they give you casino chips. And you go out on the floor and you play a few hands of blackjack. Oh, well, guess it's not my night. You turn back around, you cash in your casino chips. They give you back different cash. And now all of a sudden that cash is quote unquote clean, right? That's money laundering in the traditional sense. Now, what they're trying to say is that just using Bitcoin, never going to any other type of money, never trading it with someone else, never exchanging it with another person, never trading it for another good or service, never putting it like running it through the profits of a different industry. None of that. They're trying to say just literally you sending yourself your own Bitcoin inside of a transaction where five other people are also sending themselves their own Bitcoin. That is money laundering. That it's an insane stretch of the word. That's why I think one of the lawyers, I believe it was TDEV's lawyer, tried to make the point in the last court hearing that even if all of the accusations that are being made are taken as true, it still wouldn't meet the legal definition for money laundering. So this is like their initial step into stretching definitions, changing the way we use words. They're trying to, again, graft this Bitcoin thing into this legacy system, and it doesn't fit. It's not the same thing. And so the problem is if this case is lost, then that is essentially their victory in combining these two things that shouldn't be combined. They don't really go together. And now we're going to be using these antiquated laws that don't even work, as Econo correctly pointed out, to just do whatever we want on this new system. And that is their way of taking the power back, the very same power that we're supposed to be taking into our own hands by using Bitcoin in the first place. So it's a real travesty.
Yeah. I was going to say it's essentially opening the door to them claiming anything that's a non-standard one input, two output Bitcoin transaction can be considered money laundering. You had something to hide. You were laundering money. And it's such bullshit when you try to compare it to like anything else in the world. For example, like people use gold and jewelry to launder money all the time, right? But it's not like you're going to go after the jewelry maker and throw them in a cage for 25 years because they made something that somebody else decided to use for illicit purposes. And, you know, there's a million use cases for jewelry that are completely above board and legal. same applies to doing a Whirlpool coin join and using your Bitcoin in a way that you're going to protect yourself from. Like if your employer paid you, do you want your employer to see where you spend all your Bitcoin? Well, I certainly wouldn't. And one way I can prevent that is by running my coins through the coin join, and then my employer can't follow that. Or if I pay my rent using Bitcoin or spend it with a merchant, I don't necessarily want them looking back and seeing where my Bitcoin came from. So I can use Whirlpool to protect my privacy, which again, is the ability for me to only reveal information about myself that I want to reveal. And so like you look at anything else in the world, like cash, jewelry, tools, like cars, like if someone drives a Toyota Corolla into a parade of people and commits vehicular homicide, yeah, that person used that tool to do something horrible and illegal, but nobody's going to go after the manufacturer of the car to try and throw the people running the company in prison because someone decided to do something bad with the car.
Right on. No, I think you nailed it. And I would add, I think hopefully can speak for all three of us, is that the contention here is not that these tools couldn't be used for nefarious activity, but rather the fact that they were not marketing their services for those purposes, and that folks like yourselves were using them for completely legitimate privacy-oriented objectives is, because I think for a lot of people, like the car vehicular homicide, I think they'd be like, well, yeah, but this sounds kind of shady. Or it's like, no, but you know, what if I don't want my I think that's a perfect example, Econo. Like, what if I don't want my employer tracing what I do and when I spend the money that I've been paid and, you know, haven't paid in Bitcoin?
Even by the DOJ's own assessment in the indictment documents, they stated that only 5% of the coins that went through Whirlpool were for illicit purposes. And I think that's an overstatement. They didn't substantiate that with any facts. I mean, I guess we'll see what comes up in discovery. The point is, even by the DOJ's own assessment, 95% of the funds or the coins going through Whirlpool were by legitimate users.
That is why. I think part of the uphill battle, it seems, is that we've become so accustomed to a lack of privacy just as a society that the going out of your way to seek privacy in this manner seems almost radical. And so and then you compound that battle with like the, you know, the spicy tweets, and you've got a, you know, perhaps a jury that looks at it and says, well, it looks shady. And that's kind of that's the best assessment they can make, because they're used to just pouring out all of their information all over the internet and don't really think much of it. And those are the people who are going to adopt a CBDC on the first day it gets introduced anyway, right? So, Divert, you have something you wanted to add to that?
No, I think you're spot on. The normalization of this surveillance world that we live in, and in every part, it's a financial surveillance. Your messages are constantly surveilled. Your phone calls are constantly surveilled, and you get the classic response to that, which I'm sure everyone that's ever talked about privacy always hears, which is, "Well, I'm not doing anything wrong, so I don't really have to worry about that." And so that is the real fight here, is to get people to understand that it doesn't, that's not what's being said here. You're not doing anything wrong in your mind right now. Bitcoin is a permanent ledger. If it's going to be around, like as we all, you know, hope that it is, then all these transactions that are made, these transactions that were made in 2009, they can go back and look at all this, and they can see every single transaction. Not only can the government and the surveillance companies, literally anyone with an internet access can. So as you mentioned, your employer, any vendor that you go to a conference and you decide to use some Bitcoin to buy a hot dog at a conference, that conference vendor now can go back and trace back through the history of that Bitcoin. There's several different things that have just become so normalized that anything outside of that appears criminal. And so these guys, I wish more people got to know them in the way that myself and I know Eco kind of got to know these guys, because if you knew them, you would know that these are not criminals. They're us. They're everyday normal citizens, just regular people. They saw that they wanted this new financial paradigm in Bitcoin, and they really wanted to be a part of it. So they were working at a company, they were working on a wallet, and nobody was building the wallet that they wanted to use, right? Nobody was building the wallet that addressed the problems that they saw. So what did they decide to do? They did the classic, American pastime. They struck out on their own. They decided they're going to chase the American dream. They're going to build their own thing. They're going to build the wallet that they want to use. And they're going to address the problems that they see that nobody else is addressing. And in against all odds, it worked. Against everybody telling them that it wouldn't work, against people trying to smear them and smear their name, against them not having funding, them not having a great big team of developers around them, just a couple of people that were helping because they had passion. Like, against all these odds, these guys built this amazing service that had multiple facets. It was a node, a wallet, a chain explorer. They were helping. This is another thing that we haven't got into. They were helping other court cases, which is very, very odd timing for a couple of these things, right? So OXT was obtained by Samurai. It was, as I mentioned earlier, a block explorer. It was a visualizer. So you could, it helped you visualize the Bitcoin blockchain, and you could go in, put a transaction in, and you can basically have access to the same sort of tools that these chain surveillance companies use against you. All right. That was the premise. So the guy that built it, Laurent, he's just there's no other way to say it, just a mathematical genius. I mean, if you see this thing, it's truly, truly unbelievable. And so what ended up happening is this company, OXT, was like another arm of Samurai. And so they had people working on it, and they would help people track down funds that had maybe got stolen from them. Then when Roman, what's his last name, Eco? It's escaping me. Roman Sterlingoff from Bitcoin Fog was arrested. And this was like the first big trial where blockchain analysis was put up as evidence. And any of your listeners that are hearing this for the first time, go look at the Roman Sterlingoff case of Bitcoin Fog. It is an absolute travesty of justice. The problem with these blockchain surveillance companies is their tools are just black boxes. Nobody's allowed to see inside them. We're not allowed to see what heuristics they use. They can't give you any sort of data on false positives, false negatives. They can't tell you anything. And if you try to peer inside it, they invoke like national security, and like nobody's allowed to see this code. Several very prominent Bitcoin developers petitioned to be able to review the Chainalysis code so that they can see what this thing is doing, so that the defense can offer some sort of defense against what was being accused, what Roman was being accused of doing. None of them were allowed to do it. No one is allowed to review this code. It is a total black box mystery. And so what OXT then did was we were trying to help Roman. There was also another chain surveillance company called Elliptic. Now, Elliptic came in, and they were trying to offer services for the defense. So they were trying to show that there were several flaws in the Chainalysis assessment, that the conclusion that the state came to was that Roman Sterlingoff was the operator of Bitcoin Fog. Bitcoin Fog was a custodial Bitcoin mixer years ago, 2009, 2010. It was advertised on the dark web, all these things. Like it fit what the government is trying to say surveillance, Samurai is doing. It actually fit some of these things. All right. So they're trying to say this guy was running it. The way that they got to that conclusion was by using chain surveillance to look back through the transactions. And they determined that this was the guy that was running it. Problem is, there were several flaws in their analysis. So you had this other company, Elliptic, that was going to come in and help with the defense. OXT also was coming in and helping with the defense. last second, week of the trial, if I'm not mistaken, Elliptic gets bought by MasterCard and pulls out. And so all of a sudden, Roman Sterlingoff is left with essentially no defense. He's just stuck. And he's got nothing to offer against the Chainalysis defense. And so this guy gets convicted and is now sitting in prison.
I just wanted to highlight like how heavy the things that you're saying about this case. There's a standard in court proceedings called the Daubert standard, which defines certain things that evidence has to meet a minimum threshold of to actually be admitted into court as evidence. And this chain analysis, evidence that was used against Roman, didn't need any of those standards. And like Diverter said, they invoke national security reasons to prevent that. So basically they just sidestep the Daubert standard, entered this pseudoscience bullshit as evidence against Roman, and it's good at trial. And now the guy is convicted. And so for anyone listening, like the kind of risk you're running now is that they can just say anything you do to try and provide yourself some privacy with Bitcoin is considered money laundering. And any evidence they use against you no longer has to stand up to these long-held U.S. court standards like Dober. Sorry, yeah,
and
I'll let you continue.
Because this actually it ties in exactly to Whirlpool. So they arrested Roman, and this is a bit of a simplification, but they did the Chainalysis, did their analysis of the blockchain. And when they start tracing backwards, basically what they're looking for is the fees that were collected by Bitcoin Fog. They're looking at where did those fees go. So they try to chase those fees down to see whose wallet they landed in. And then as soon as they can tie an identity to that wallet, we arrest that guy. Right. So here's the problem. Back in 2009, 2010, 2011, KYC was not the prevalent just everywhere thing that we have today. Like it did not exist in that same. It was essentially optional. You could do KYC or you could not do KYC. So the problem, Roman did KYC. So he handed over his identity. All right. When there were like 10 or 11 or 12 other potential quote unquote suspects that none of them had done KYC. So there was actually no tie to their identity. They couldn't prove who these people are. And then there's this one guy sticking out, and here's his full identity. Well, there he is. It's case solved. And so the only real protection against that would be something like Whirlpool, where if they can't just go back and say, oh, well, it was this guy, and that because you did KYC back in these days, if you had used a tool like Whirlpool, then it would have broken that link. And it prevents you from an unnecessary and unjust prosecution in this case. Like that's yet another case. Like this guy Roman could literally have been any of us. Like he helped some people set up a website, and he was an early Bitcoin adopter. And what probably happened was that he sold some Bitcoin at a conference. Like he's just trading Bitcoin with people at a conference. And the best that we could come up with is probably one of the people that he was trading Bitcoin with was the actual owner of Bitcoin Fog. But because there was absolutely no protection in place for him, it looks like it's him. And he's the only one that did KYC out of the bunch. So boom, there's our guy. And now you can't provide any evidence to the contrary, and their evidence doesn't have to meet any sort of scientific standard. It's outrageous, the things that are happening. And then
it's wild.
And that's just the Roman Sterlingoff case is just like one prong of like this multi-prong attack on self-custody, privacy, and free speech that's happening right now. And the other prong is Tornado Cash, and the other prong is Samurai Wallet. And it's just going to keep getting worse. They don't want you to have custody of your funds or have any privacy because the financial services have all been weaponized. People forget so quickly, but it was just a couple years ago that the Canadian trucker convoy was using Bitcoin, and people who were found out to have donated to the cause were having their bank account seized and completely locked out of any sort of basic financial services. And so these people were turning to Bitcoin. And like the Canadian government just like lost their mind and threw everything except the kitchen sink at these activists. So it's, you know, the trajectory is clear. it is a multi-pronged approach, and man, people just really need to stand up and fight for what they believe in, because we stand to lose everything.
Just one final kind of nail that I think really brings this home is, as we've established, samurai have always stood for what they believed is right, and they're not afraid to say it out loud. Just before these indictments came down, shocking timing, I know, but there was a bill that was going to be attempted to be passed, and you have an open period before the bill is passed where public comments can be made. You may have seen these going around Twitter, where sometimes they'll tell you, you know, write a letter to your Congress, whatever. You have an open period where you can comment on these different bills before they actually get passed and go into law. So there was one of these, some such bills, and the details escape me a bit. Maybe Eco can help me out with that, but it was basically yet another trampling of our financial privacy. So several companies, people, places got together, and you know, they sent letters and all kinds of stuff, and made them very public that this was an outrage and that it couldn't be allowed to stand. Samurai, in particular, headlined one of probably the biggest collaboration of companies that wrote one of these opinion pieces back to say, hey, this is crazy, you can't do this. And so Samurai, historically, there were a lot of things, a lot of different companies that Samurai did not really get along with. Let's just say that. All right. And the reasoning for that is that Samurai believed that they basically went against all the things that Bitcoin are. KYC basically goes against all the things Bitcoin are. So these custodial KYC exchanges like, you know, River or Swan, things of that nature, like, they're not the best of buddies. Okay. But in this one scenario, all these companies came together and all these companies decided to sign on to Samurai's letter. So the headliner of this letter was Samurai Wallet, accompanied by, I don't even know how many, was it 20 or 30 different companies in the Bitcoin space, River, Swan, exchanges, wallets, all these people all joined together and signed it on this letter. So all the comments worked. The bill did not go into place, but you can see yet again how that puts a really big, bright target on Samurai Wallet. Here's this company that was able to get all these other companies to put aside whatever differences they have and stand together for this one single cause. That's dangerous. Those guys are dangerous. All right, so you got guys, they headline this letter. They're offering defensive strategies in court against the government. And then, you know, just a matter of weeks later, they are themselves indicted.
Yeah, it was a rule proposal by FinCEN that would effectively make collaborative transactions a crime. And there were 25 different companies who jumped on board and signed that letter along with Samurai Wallet. And the thing about submitting these letters to FinCEN is that, like, the before any sort of rule change, they have to open up like a comment period. And if a letter is submitted, like, it has to be considered. The things that are in that letter have to be considered and discussed. And it helped in this case. But to Diverter's point, it wasn't long after that the Samurai Wallet developers who had lined that letter were then indicted themselves.
Yeah, go figure. I think what concerns me the most about this is the unfortunate circumstance for Samurai is that they were in such a niche industry, right? Like, there are only so many people who have eyes on the proceedings, everything going on. You know, back to the example of like a car manufacturer, if executives from Ford or, you know, GM were indicted because of a DUI that, you know, one of their customers had, people would be up in arms. You know, like, what's going on here? Mm-hmm. But there just aren't people paying attention. There probably a lot of people have heard about it the same way people heard about the FTX collapse a few years ago, even if they're not in that space or whatever. But I think the problem is we talk a lot about slowly then suddenly in Bitcoin, and you know, people use it to reference price appreciation or adoption or, you know, hyper-Bitcoinization or whatever. But I think we see a slowly then suddenly happening in the other direction when it comes to free speech and legal due process, and it's all playing out before our eyes. And you guys are hitting on some really good examples of it. But the average normie who listens to this, I think, might say, yeah, this makes a lot of sense. Yeah, that's kind of crazy, you know, and then go about their day, go catch the game tonight, and, yep. you know, whatever. And I think mm-hmm. that's the problem is if the longer we take these liberties for granted, the more likely we are to not have them 5 years from now, 10 years from now. And I think that's the tragedy of this. Like, we just have this societal complacency right now, and apathy toward some really big issues. So I'm hopeful, you know, this podcast and the work you guys are doing more generally to spread the word is going to be impactful. I want to sort of round for home here. So could one of you describe where we're at in the legal proceedings? Like, what comes next for these guys, and then we'll get to how we can help.
So both the developers are under house arrest, or I think the right term is home detention. So they're out on bond. I think combined, they've put up more than $3 million in bond to be able to be at home instead of in a jail cell right now. The proceedings have just entered the discovery phase. The prosecution has some more discovery documents that they need to provide to the defense team. So like in layman's terms, the government prosecution has handed over like 1/3 of the information that they're using against Samurai Wallet in this case. And so the defense team for Samurai Wallet is starting to parse through all that so that they can mount a defense based on what they know the prosecution has to use against them. So I think the next trial is set for like the middle of December. I imagine with the holidays and the amount of data that's included in all of its discovery information, I imagine the next trial date is probably going to get pushed back to like early next year. But I think there's one we'll see next, or like a number of discovery proceedings. Some motions are probably going to get entered. And then eventually at some point, based on what happens, they'll probably set trial at some point next year.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. The legal system, if you've ever been a part of it, it is a grind. It's very slow. It's very methodical. There are several dates. There are several motions. Like, it's going to take quite a while. And to Eco's point, they so far have handed over, get this number, 8 terabytes of information. 8 terabytes. If it was put onto paper and stacked one on top of each other, it would stack to the moon and back 22 times. That's how much information that they've so far given to the defense for discovery. So you've got to comb through all this stuff, 8 terabytes worth. So
that sounds fishy to me, because you don't have 8 terabytes in almost, I can't imagine terabytes is commonly used in a case against a couple of individuals, maybe in a massive environmental case with huge global conglomerates or something like that. But that seems to me like a means of just distracting the defense from building a case again. Like, you know, how do you tackle 8 terabytes of information?
Just buried in paperwork.
Yeah. Yeah. That wasn't even all of it. They still have to hand over more. But the really sketchy part about that is, I think it's a tactic by the prosecution to obfuscate and to overwhelm the defense team, because now the defense has to spend more resources, which means more money to comb through this 8 terabytes, because now is their opportunity. And to have any sort of like fair chance to mount a defense, because the prosecution can pick anything. Imagine picking any one of those pages at random that's stacked to the moon and back 22 times. And if the defense missed it during discovery and didn't jump on the opportunity to like keep it, to mount a defense against it, and that comes up in front of a jury and the defense is like blindsided by it, like that's going to be really bad and disastrous. So I think it's a tactic by the prosecution to try and obfuscate what they're actually going to be using against these guys at trial.
Yeah, it negates the point of discovery. The point of discovery is transparency as to the evidence at hand.
Right.
And effectively what you've done is you've probably thrown in, you know, a few hundred thousand documents and you know, pieces that have nothing to do with anything, just to, yeah, to yeah. your point, to obfuscate.
Funnily enough, in my opinion, what the government has just done is they've just went through Whirlpool. They've just done their version of Whirlpool. They've just put all of the pieces of paper and they just scrambled them up and said, here, figure it out. Like that's their version of what we're trying to do here.
It's just evil. All righty. So let's talk about what we as a community can do to pitch in. Where can we donate to the defense fund? You guys, at this point, you give me a link. You guys have taught me a lot today. I will be heading over there right after this, this podcast and chipping in.
Yeah, love to. Go ahead, Eco.
I was just going to say, I think the best thing people can do to chip in is to put your money where your mouth is, help these guys in their legal defense fund, which is p2prites.org/donate.html. You can go there, can donate with Bitcoin, you can donate with fiat, believe it's tax deductible. Like if you want to like get a receipt for your donation, can write that off if you want to do that. And I think that is what's going to help Samurai Wallet here and now in the current moment. And then I think like going forward and continuing to use our freedoms that we enjoy. If you're a developer, go to the ashigaru.com. I think it's ashigar.rs is their website. That's the fork of Stammering Wallet. You can go, you can find their code repository through the .onion URL. And if you're a developer, like start contributing to that project to help keep these privacy tools maintained and active and working for everyday people around the globe, like activists, blue collar workers, and those 95% of users by the DOJ's own inflated estimates that are using this stuff day in and day out for completely normal and healthy privacy reasons.
Yeah. And at the site that he mentioned, the p2prites.org/donate.html, there you can, as he mentioned, donate in Bitcoin or fiat. You can also choose how your donation is used. So they have three different options you can choose from. The second option is specifically titled U.S. Versus Rodriguez and Hill. This is Samurai Wallet. So if this you want to donate some funds to this specific defense, once you've heard they have to figure out how to go through 8 terabytes of data somehow, then you could choose option number two. If for whatever reason this particular case doesn't strike your fancy, but you do want to contribute to just the general defense of the P2P rights, then they also have a general fund option that you can donate to, and that will go directly to like their core activities, legal defenses, you know, all those things. None of that goes to overhead, but they do have overhead. So there is a third option called the operations fund. So, you know, all this stuff costs money, unfortunately. So you can also donate to just cover the general like administrative costs of running the peer-to-peer rights fund. So there's three different donation options for you to choose from. I would love for people to be able to donate to all three because they certainly need it. But, you know, we'll just hopefully we've at least raised some awareness because, as mentioned earlier, I promise you this case is not just about privacy. Even if you don't care about privacy at all, if you do care about self-custody, then this is something that I implore you to look into.
This is a wild distortion of justice. And some of this is beyond me. I will, for anyone listening, I'll make sure we flash up that website on the screen too when on the final podcast. I'll put it in the show notes. I'm going to be heading over there right after this and contributing. One last comment. I don't want to distract from that because that's step one. If you're listening, go do that. But the second thing too is, you know, something we sort of touched on is this lack of awareness of these sorts of problems in our legal system. In, you know, I mean, even in the way other, like I heard about like the George Soros buying 200 radio stations and the way mm-hmm. the FCC went about it and approved it was unconventional, I guess you would say. and I think people just don't understand the impact of those sorts of deviations from the norm. And we go far enough down this path. And, you know, I mean, the hell, the Bitcoin way. I mean, all we do is self-custody. Like, we help people take self-custody of their Bitcoin. And it's a horrible precedent for, you know, three-letter agencies to start making their own rules on the fly. It's a horrible precedent to, under the guise of money laundering or conspiracy to, you know, operate a, you know, a licensed money transmitter, to basically have a case where you say, well, part of the problem was it was self-custody. And well, now self-custody is on the chopping block, you know, I mean, it's, they're just so, it's a slippery slope and very dangerous. So my plea to anyone listening is, besides contributing to this particular cause, raise awareness with friends and family, share your voice online as to these sorts of issues as they arise, because it feels like it's becoming daily. So guys, anything to add to that?
Yeah, I certainly believe that if the government is successful in the Tornado Cash case and the Samurai Wallet case, there's absolutely nothing standing between the government going after anyone who has a Lightning node, anyone who potentially even just runs like a regular Bitcoin node, anyone who's mining Bitcoin, anyone who develops a wallet that's self-custodial. And I'd even go as far as to put hardware wallets in that category too. So I think it will literally affect every single aspect of the ecosystem if the government is successful in those two cases. And if, with the precedent set by the Roman Sterlingov case, they don't have to maintain the Dobert standard to enter evidence against people anymore either. So there's literally going to be nothing stopping them from going after anybody and everybody they want to go after who's trying to use a tool like Bitcoin to subvert the weaponization of basic financial services that has been going on for so long.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, guys, I got one more question for you, unrelated, but this is one that I like to ask everyone at the end of the podcast, and I think it's one you guys could have interesting opinions on. So the question is this: what is an unpopular opinion that you hold, and you get bonus points if it's unpopular, even amongst Bitcoiners?
I don't know. I'll just go with an old classic of mine, I guess. The one that seems to rile people up the most is that I wholeheartedly disagree with the notion of quote unquote hyper Bitcoinization. I wholeheartedly disagree with the notion of mass adoption. I think they're both complete farces, pipe dreams. It'll never happen. And if it does happen, it'll be of a thing that isn't even Bitcoin anymore. Most people don't actually want to be their own bank. Most people don't actually want to take full control over their finances. Most people just want to grill and watch the game, and they don't want to have full total control over their finances and their family's finances. They like the having a bank that if something happens, they can get their money back from. They like having all these safeguards, and it makes them feel good that the government is quote unquote here to help. Any sort of suggestion that there will be a mass adoption of Bitcoin or hyper Bitcoinization, and it will actually resemble the thing that we know as Bitcoin today, is just outrageous.
So it begs the question then, what do you see as the trajectory for Bitcoin? If not hyper Bitcoinization upending the financial system, what's the use case?
Empowering individuals. It's about the empowerment of the individuals that do want to be empowered. And so my problem with the whole notion of mass adoption and hyper Bitcoinization is it results in us making trade-offs in search of those end goals that we'll never actually reach, but we keep making trade-offs to try to reach it. And so the more trade-offs that we make, we start losing the essence of what Bitcoin actually is. And the people that actually do want to use it and will use it, they lose the thing that they had. They don't have the same amount of power back from them. So I think Bitcoin will stay essentially at what it is for most people, as long as we can put up enough of a fight not to totally hand over the reins to, you know, some custodial or pseudo custodial version of Bitcoin. As long as we put up a big enough fight to where people actually can still take their own full self custody, then I think there's a place for Bitcoin in the world to be very, very impactful So I think it really matters a lot. That's the only reason I'm still here. Like, I wouldn't still be here if it didn't matter. But the people that need Bitcoin really need Bitcoin. The people that we want to buy Bitcoin, I'll be honest with you, I don't really care if they do or not. I want the people that need it to be able to use it.
That's a good one. I think you'll piss some people off. Good. Kano, what do you got?
I mean, I totally agree with Diverter. Think NGU is one of the most dangerous means in the Bitcoin space. And people who are just using Bitcoin as a conduit to increase their fiat holdings, you know, they don't need Bitcoin to do that. So I agree with Diverter. You know, I don't believe in mass adoption. I don't think that's ever going to happen. I think the Trojan horse theory that like was kind of this meme where like as Bitcoin gets adopted, it'll creep into government. And then somehow the government will just like magically stop doing government things like indicting open source developers. You know, I don't think that's happened. In fact, I think we've been witnessing the opposite happen lately. Yeah, I mean, like my contrarian opinion, like totally not Bitcoin related, but, you know, I think COVID-19 was a bioweapon and the vaccine was designed to murder people in an attempt for population control.
Yes. That's my guy.
Okay. No, it doesn't have to be Bitcoin related. It just has to make some people mad, ruffle some feathers. So no, I think those are both good ones. So I got one question then is a follow-up. The one thing, so I think what you guys say makes sense about hyper-Bitcoinization, certainly in any near term. I mean, I think you have to be right. Over the long term, I guess time will tell. I'm curious though, to what extent you see like nation state, like game theory affecting that thesis, because, you know, in my mind, if you had a large nation state who's, you know, let's say like Russia or someone like that, who, mm-hmm. Can't, you know, economically compete with the United States, sick of using the US dollar for trade, mm-hmm. For them to adopt Bitcoin would absolutely hinder government power because they don't have the monopoly on their, you know, their national currency. But would some event like that then force other nations to adopt Bitcoin in a more meaningful, you know, quote unquote, hyper Bitcoinized way because they can't outrun the best form of money? Would that change the thesis at all? Or am I?
So I think there's I think there's a bit of a flawed premise in there that we're starting from that's leading to a flawed conclusion, in my opinion, and mm-hmm. which is that the adoption of Bitcoin by, say, a Russia would be the adoption of the thing that we call Bitcoin. The adoption of Bitcoin in Russia would then become Russian Bitcoin. So they're not going to, like, governments are stupid and inept by all means, but they're really, really good at holding on to power. Like, they're really good at it, and they'll scratch and claw and bleed and die for this power. That's the one thing they have. So, if they were to adopt a Bitcoin, then I certainly would expect, especially in a place like a Russia or a North Korea, one of the places that really we could see them adopting Bitcoin to get out of US dollar hegemony, that would make sense. The problem is with the type of government and leadership that those countries in particular have, there's just no way. They're not going to have totalitarian type controls over the use of said Bitcoin. You're going to have to hold that Bitcoin in an approved registered exchange. There's not going to be self-custody. You're not going to be able to just trade it amongst yourselves as you wish. All this stuff is going to be traced because Bitcoin has no privacy protections in its baseline protocol. Like, it would actually become an arm of a surveillance state. Like, it would be it to be quite honest with you, Bitcoin at its base layer with no app level privacy protections is a surveillance country's dream. It is the dream of a country. If you can make everybody use Bitcoin, you can follow every single transaction they've got. If it has no privacy protections, you force them to associate their real world identity with their Bitcoin identity, and boom, you're done. You can strike down dissent. There is no outside. People would be using the dollar under the table. So it would be a reversal of the Bitcoin thesis, in my opinion. So I think that's kind of the difference, is As far as price appreciation and as far as purchasing power and helping against inflation, I certainly think that, you know, nation state adoptions help in that realm. I mean, it just makes sense. Scarcity is what scarcity is. But from a real world usage standpoint, I think it would be going backwards almost.
Yeah, basically CBDC. It would, yes. They call it Russian Bitcoin or whatever, but you effectively got a CBDC.
Yep.
Yeah. All right. Yeah.
And I think the thing people have to understand is that Bitcoin is just software. Yeah, that software can be used as a tool for financial freedoms, but it can just as easily be used as a tool for tyrannical control. And I think a lot of people just take that for granted.
Perfect, guys. Well, I'll revert back quickly to go support Samurai to everyone listening.
Please.
I don't want that to be a distraction, but it's always a fun question to ask. And hey, you guys gave me a lot of knowledge, a lot of things to think about, and I think everyone's going to benefit from this. So thank you both so much for your time.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Yeah, no, I really appreciate it, man. This is very important. I really, really appreciate you having us on here. We're not talking about it in the places that it needs to be talked about. We've made the rounds on, you know, the privacy podcast and things of that nature. But until we're talking to people that maybe they don't care so much about privacy, and that's totally fine. But I really want people to understand when they use words like a money transmitter can be someone that you don't have to have control of the funds, like you're assisting by any and all means. When they start using words like that to define who a money transmitter is, you get what Eco's talking about: node operators, miners, lightning node operators. All these people are now money transmitters. So I really appreciate the opportunity to get in front of your audience and maybe talk to some people that haven't thought about this before.
Absolutely. Thank you both so much. I appreciate your time today. Hope you guys have a good one, and I'm sure we'll catch up again sometime.
All right. Thank you, man.
And cheers, guys. And that's a wrap. I really hope you enjoyed this conversation. If you did, do me a favor, like this video or subscribe to our channel wherever you're listening. Would really appreciate that. And hey, let's pitch in and do our job to defend these Samurai developers who have done so much for the Bitcoin space. You can donate, spread the word, do whatever you can. And of course, if you need help with proper Bitcoin self-custody, with protecting your online privacy, setting up a privacy phone, or even a Plan B residency to citizenship option, go to thebitcoinway.com/podcast. You can schedule a free 30-minute consult with a member of our team. We hope to see you there. And as always, stay safe, stay sovereign, and remember, the yield on Bitcoin is freedom.